Are we really going to get government efficiency from a socialist? Last week, New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani launched a new initiative, COGE, the Commission on Government Efficiency. He says it is intended to eliminate outdated bureaucratic barriers and ensure that taxpayer money is spent wisely. That sounds good. So will this actually make New York government leaner and more efficient? Or is this just another slick marketing gimmick? Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. I'm your host, Peter Suderman. And today I am joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward, Matt Welch, and Nick Gillespie. All right, let's talk about Zoran Mamdani and COGE. When Mamdani announced the commission last week, he said, New Yorkers deserve a city government as careful with their money as they are. Matt, you are a New Yorker. How careful with your money are you? And is there any reason to think that this commission will bring about a leaner, more efficient government for New York?
The fact that it's called COGE shows that it's much more in the spirit of trolling than it is of actually taking that maxim seriously. And you don't need to start a commission to act on the seriousness of those words. That should be what any elected official thinks at all times. You're in charge of the public purse. Of course you're going to spend every dollar wisely. But of course, in Zoran Mamdani's case, just like almost every single big city Democratic mayor in this country, he's not. It was a $125 billion budget. It's not being spent carefully, and it's not going to be spent carefully. I look forward to them trying, and I want them to succeed to do that. And there's no reason, based on the composition of the board and the track record of Mamdani and the track record of New York, to expect anything good that will come out of this.
Yeah, it's like if you've got to have a commission, it's like that's, we need an efficiency holiday. We need an efficiency week, right? Like this is going to be a special efficiency program because most of the time we don't do it. There's kind of an admission there. And actually, Catherine, that's what I want to ask you about. Some other things that Mamdani said when he was announcing this. For too long, bureaucracy has stood in the way of delivering the housing, transit, childcare, and public services our city needs. He also said, restoring faith in government starts with proving government can actually deliver, which at least implies that currently it is not.
Yeah, it's exactly the same energy as printing the Paperwork Reduction Act notice on every government form. Like, that's the vibe here. No, I feel like I am being choked out by the monkey's paw. Like, I just want for somebody...
That is a Matt Welch level.
No, it's not. The metaphor is not mixed. The metaphor is consistent. And here's the situation is that people keep... saying politicians, people with real power, keep saying words that sound like the thing I want them to do. But it's like you have to be really careful how you phrase your wish because you're going to get it good and hard. And that, I'm sure, is what will happen here. Somehow it will be the case, just like with DOGE, where we had kind of a lot of fuss and in theory in the name of government efficiency and minimization, and in fact got neither. I assume the same thing will be true in New York. It isn't the same mistake that they're going to make, though. So that is, like, I get that it's a riff, it's a joke, whatever. The mistake they're going to make is the opposite one. Elon Musk moved too fast and without any regard for the rules and without any real authorization. And as a result, everything he did had to be undone and also was done in a chaotic way. Mamdani is going to move very, very slowly with everybody bought in. There is going to be process upon process upon process. And
but you don't care about the stakeholders?
I don't.
Do you not have a heart for the stakeholders of New York?
My cultural recommendation is about stakeholders. So we will come back at the end to that question.
Nick, what does it say just about the state of the Democratic Party that someone like Mamdani, who in a big speech said something to the effect of there's no problem too small for government to solve, is now doing this, even if it's a troll, even if it's for show? Like, it feels that he has to at least say the words, hey, maybe government isn't delivering. It should do better.
Yeah, I think it's good. You know, people are unhappy. New Yorkers are not, you know, regardless of their inability to find and run a Republican who is presentable in public. And that's not the voters' fault. It's the Republican Party's fault. But New Yorkers aren't happy with things. I know, and I suspect Matt has had this experience too. Some city services are remarkably efficient and easy to work with, and others are nightmares. And unfortunately, the more important something is, the more likely it is to be on the nightmare scale. I was looking in thinking about this. To me, this is also, you know, it's not even a public relations ploy, you know, to go to what Catherine was talking about. This is just a pro forma throat clearing type of thing. But New York, according to its own financial budget documents and things like that, New York City spent last fiscal year spent something like $13,500 per capita on people in New York, like it the taxpayers. Philadelphia spent $3,500. Chicago spent $2,100. It is unbelievable how much more money per person New York City spends, which helps explain why it's that much more expensive here and it collects more in taxes per capita, et cetera. But it is unfucking believable that it is spending that much more and somehow it never trickles down into the street like the, you know, homeless urine that is ever present on the corner of 46th and 9th.
I think we need a big government program to remove the urine.
You know what?
Right?
We could use a little one. I don't know. You know, unemployed circus clowns, you know, could be sweeping up all over the city. But, you know, this is the question. And unfortunately, you know, Mamdani, he has his base, you know, and they love him and they're going to love this. And they're going to say, this is upbeat and makes me feel, you know, the warmth of collectivism and things like that. But it is not going to do anything fundamentally to change one of the most one of the biggest problems and most important things to change, which is the size, scope, and spending of the government of the city of New York.
Matt Welch, as a resident of New York, imagine just for a moment that this commission were somewhat serious, that we're actually looking to put together some proposals, some ideas for making the government more efficient, leaner, for spending taxpayer money better, maybe even spending less of it. What would be a couple of the items on your list?
I mean, like, imagine that unicorns could play the banjo. Go.
That sounds great. Sign me up.
Yeah. I mean.
Yeah, I think I've been reading that novel.
The unicorn banjo players can hang out with these circus urine cleaners, and it's going to be a show.
I might start with.
That's the spirit of New York right there.
Of stopping the city government from opening 5 grocery stores. That might be the kind of an opening bid here, you know, it's actually the lowering of taxes, the removal of things that don't need to exist. I don't think that we need to have a city run pre-K daycare situation, which Mamdani ran on, which Nick is obviously going to try to use.
That's the only reason I'm having kids at the age of 62, Matt. You just can't leave money like that on the table.
You look around everywhere in New York and you see just dastardly inefficiency. There's a subway stop 100 feet from where I'm sitting here, where they're paying probably 2 different people to stand around and do nothing while watching teenagers jump over the turnstiles. Like, what are you there for? So maybe
they're not even counting them, like, you know, at a club or something.
I don't know. You just sort of see it all around. One thing I would say is that what you would see if this was serious would that there might be a Republican on this board. The chairman of this board ran the Democratic National Committee and then also the Open Society Foundation. He's his quote was like, you know, we're going to bring together in the same room activists, a government, and nonprofits. It's like, oh, because weren't we doing that all the time and everything sucks? One thing that you would bring together would be like, oh, the Manhattan Institute. It's actually in Manhattan, does local policy. Might not agree with all of it, but it's very interesting. And they've done a lot of work on this over the years. The Empire Policy Center, you'd bring those guys. You bring in the Reason Foundation for pensions instead of just deciding not to pay and contribute to your pensions this year to meet your budget gap goals or whatever. None of that is existent here. Similarly to how that wasn't really existent in Washington with Doge and Elon Musk, they're not going to the people who've been working on these problems. So what they're going to do is get the stakeholders in the room and figure out a way to probably try to rewrite the charter of the city of New York to make it easier to tax people. That's the most likely scenario here.
Catherine, how does this play with sort of the other emerging faction in the Democratic Party, the abundance folks? Like, just so like he is Yes, I'm not asking Matt Welch this question because I know what's going to happen if I ask Matt Welch this question. But there is this, sort of factional movement within the Democratic Party that is trying to do government efficiency, in particular regulatory reduction, for building houses. And I do think that at least a lot of those folks are really serious about it. But when you get to the level of the politicians and the people on the commission, I'm not so sure that they're serious about it. Does this maybe downgrade your assessment of how likely it is that we get the Ezra Klein abundance vision for the Democratic Party?
The abundance folks are to Koch as real libertarians and government cutters were to Doge.
Like, excited about it when it was announced?
Excited about it in a way that is frankly foolish and they will feel embarrassed about later. That's my guess. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm too pessimistic. I hope I am. But I think the trappings, the kind of rhetoric around this can absolutely be read as adjacent to the abundance agenda. And I do think, you know, like an outsider type mayor coming into any major city in the United States is going to look around and be like, wow, it would be cool if we could build stuff in the city. That, why is that impossible? Can we fix it? Like, it's the right question. I just don't think that any of the players here will get to an answer that looks like Derek Thompson's answer, much as in the end, Doge did not get to answers that looked like our answers.
Yeah, I think this is right. I mean, the abundance folks, I don't agree with all of them, but I think that in many cases, their hearts are in the right place. They have a bunch of good ideas. But when
Everyone's
you get to the level
the
of
right
the politicians.
Place.
Yeah, so many other people's hearts are in the wrong place.
But you're actually hearing stuff from them that is like, oh, this sounds like, at least directionally, like the stuff you've been hearing from Reason, from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, from Cato and Mercatus
about the
burdens of regulation. And
yeah,
they were saying Democrats need to take
politicians.
That stuff seriously.
Yeah, you're not hearing that
yes,
from
and that's
politicians.
The problem. And that is exactly the problem, is that politicians are adopting that on a rhetorical level. You see that in California. You see that in Massachusetts and in New York, you know, the sort of the three biggest blue states, that they are adopting the abundance rhetoric without the abundance policies. And that's why we are not going to get the abundance agenda in these blue states, because the politicians just won't do it because the Democrats aren't there.
You asked what might be a cut to make. The New York City public schools spend about $44,000 per student. That's according to the city's own figures from the most recent fiscal year. Here would be a start. Say, you know what? We are only going to spend $35,000 per student in New York City in public schools, effective immediately. And we're going to take that $10,000, you know, or $9,000 a year and park it towards either paying the retirement funds that we are just like suspending payment on so that the taxpayer can get really screwed a couple of years down the road, or pay down, you know, the budget debt that, you know, there's a $12 billion basically a structural deficit in New York City's budget, which is leading to really bad bond ratings and things like that. So that's one thing they could do. At, I would argue, no material effect on education, because it's clear that most of that $44,000 is not coming anywhere close the adorable Moppets who are, you know, marching in and out of an increasing number of public schools and charter schools in New York that are in old office buildings, because they're not even using the physical plant that's there. That would be something I'd be excited about. I don't think that'll happen.
All right. Speaking of the state of the Democratic Party, Mike Pence said something this weekend. You guys remember Mike Pence, right? He was vice president, sort of hard to imagine, but he was vice president on the ticket with Donald Trump. And he was on Meet the Press over the weekend. And he said, I think in many respects, Republicans have lost our way, but Democrats have lost their mind. So ignoring the singular mind, obviously, Democrats are not all of one brain. Nick, do you agree with Pence here that Democrats have just gone totally crazy?
No, I don't. Or rather, let me put it this way. His comparison between Republicans and Democrats is ridiculous. This is one of the reasons why Mike Pence, ultimately, he did the right thing on January 6th. He was a completely ineffectual useless vice president to stand up to Trump when he really needed to. He was a mediocre governor of Indiana who was a drug warrior and did a bunch of other socially conservative things that didn't help that state, but didn't overwhelm it with economic issues and things like that. But the Democrats are terrible. That there is no question. And we can leave aside all the Graham Platner stuff where it does take a shitty Democratic Party to say that a fake working class oyster farmer who's actually like a trust fund kid who went to elite public school or private schools, that his turning his Nazi tattoo into some kind of weird Iron John, still Nazi wolf tattoo, that's like not even in the top five of what's wrong with Graham Platner. The Democratic Party is in a terrible situation. They have, they are as poorly rated generically by voter affiliation as the Republicans. So they suck. Okay. They are capable of not putting together anybody who can speak a coherent sentence for the mayor of Los Angeles. The governor of California race is, a total foobar for them and things like that. And that means that they are exactly as stupid and as self-destructive as the Republican Party. And the thing with Pence, he's trying to weasel his way back into, I don't know what, like a centrist, right of center kind of responsible discussion. It's like, I wouldn't be talking about the Democratic Party right now when you have Donald Trump. The least offensive thing you can say is that 7 of the 9 acts that his team tapped for America's state county fair have dropped out, including Milli Vanilli. And it's like, yeah, the Democrats have lost their mind. The Republicans have merely lost their way after years of tariffs and shooting people in the face, protesting ICE. No, I don't think we should play the game that Mike Pence is trying to set up.
Did you see the meme that was going around? And it's a promo shot of Milli Vanilli, except both of them have been terrifyingly had their faces photoshopped with Marco Rubio, because he's Milli Vanilli. Yeah. Anyway, so you want us to ignore the Graham Platner thing? And I'm not sure.
No, I don't. I'm not saying ignore that. I'm saying ignore Mike Pence trying to be like, oh, you know what, Republicans, we just need a little bit of new direction. Like, we need not to kick out people like Thomas Massie and have Ken Paxton, who is just a horrible, horrible human being and a shitty politician, get the nomination for the Texas Senate seat from a reliable Republican incumbent. That's what I'm saying. It's like Pence is full of shit when he's trying to be like, hey, we're just 1 or 2 feet away from normalcy. The other party is the problem. The Republican Party, which he is part of and supposedly has some influence on, is the bigger problem for him right now.
And
that's all.
And the rhyme is right there. Democrats have lost their mind. Republicans have lost their spine. It's kind of a bigger deal than like, oh, I just wandered off the path in the forest. God, just call me and I'll be right back on it. No, you won't. You're rallying around Ken Paxton. Like, look in the mirror. You're rallying around Ken Paxton. You're like trying to screw your brain up to think that James Tallarico is some kind of soy boy, vegan pillow biter, or God knows what Jesse Waters is saying these days. And you're backing someone who is just absolutely an ogre and totally corrupt, has been impeached several times. No one is defending him on any merit at whatsoever. But somehow, if you say that the Democrats have lost their mind enough, then you can convince yourself into backing any horrible person. I think we are beautifully cursed and blessed at the same time to have the Platner race against Susan Collins and Ken Paxton against James Tallarico, because everyone is showing their colors. A sane polity would look at this from the outside. Granted, none of us live in those states, and so that's the most important thing. But from the outside, if you're going to look at all this and come to the conclusion that you'd rather have Ken Paxton and you'd rather have Graham Platner, you are telling on yourself about what you care about modern America and modern American character.
Isn't this also, though, this is just the new version of what people used to say, 20 years ago, when they would say like, oh, the Democrats are the stupid party and the Republicans are the evil party. Or sometimes people would say the opposite because they would just say whatever was serving their interests at the moment. Like that, it's functioning the same way to suggest that like, yes, it is an undeniable fact that both parties are not sending their best. But the other guys are still worse in an important way than our guys. And, you know, like, this is the job. Like, even Mike Pence, who is, I think, to borrow a phrase from Peter Suderman, like, his heart's in the right place. He's trying to salvage the Republican Party, which is a different project than just speak truth and do government better.
What's he doing to salvage the Republican Party other than attack the Democrats is even worse?
I don't know. I'm not a Pencean Republican in any particular sense, but I think his efforts to draw the party back toward a kind of vaguely Reaganite center of gravity would be better than the present circumstances all around. And, you know, he seems to
be doing that pick on him, but, you know, way. Peter is the one who raised it, though. Like, what is he doing? What spending has he said that we should cut? How has he critiqued foreign policy under both Bush and Obama and Trump and Biden? You know, it's just he's fundamentally not a serious guy. He looks like a politician. He sounds like a politician. He shows up every once in a while when he has a book to hawk. And it's like, you know, he's as responsible as the decline of the Republican Party to where it is at now as anybody else. He's, you know, he was a congressman who left Congress because he had term limited himself. Good for him. He was a governor of Indiana, you know, and then he tried to make it into the bigs and ended up being, you know, Trump's shoeshine boy. And was not as bad as he could have been, but it's like he doesn't have a serious reform policy for politics or the Republican Party. Democrats don't either. I mean, and this is, you know, their autopsy, which is kind of similar to when the Republicans did their 2012 autopsy. You know, they buried their autopsy, which was kind of bullshit to begin with. I don't know, you know, and this is one of the reasons why I suspect none of us really vote for major party candidates most of the time. I don't know how to fix it.
The short answer to what Mike Pence is doing is that he started a nonprofit in Washington to kind of scoop up the people who've been driven out of or fled in horror at the Heritage Foundation. So he's trying to start a new think tank.
Does anybody have anything to say about Graham Plattner specifically? Catherine?
Yeah.
Like this is, I mean, so I brought this up, right? Like this is, I wanted to talk about this sort of as the way Mike Pence is talking about this, right? But I also wanted to talk specifically about Graham Plattner and Democratic candidates, because this is the story that has been in the news over the weekend, which is that he sent all of these sexts to other women. I mean, it's somewhat unclear exactly how many. He has a profile on Kik that shows him, K-I-K, which is a private messaging app that is at least has a reputation for being facilitating salacious exchanges. And his profile picture shows him in a towel with some of his tattoos visible.
Could be a tasteful towel.
Yeah.
And there is an argument that is happening over, does this matter at all, or should we just judge him on his policies? Does the towel matter, Catherine?
So listen, I was told by my colleagues in the DC office not to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. My entire thoughts about this man have to do with free association, word association with his first name. I just want our listeners and viewers to know about the invention of the graham cracker, because I feel like this is really important. Idea of the graham cracker is that it was supposed to be part of a bland, non-spicy, uninvigorating, sugarless diet that was ultimately supposed to save America's children from excessive masturbation. Yes. And if there is someone who is wearing
his name... I did not realize where that sentence was going.
I know. And here we are at the phrase excessive masturbation. If there is someone who is wearing his name more badly right now than Graham, I do not know who it is. It's bad. It's all bad. It seems to me, though, that we've done the scandals in the wrong order. The sexting scandal should warm you up for the Nazi scandal, not vice versa.
He's also running against the very unpopular Republican who I think was Squanto's first wife, who is like an 800-year-old non-entity. Okay. Yeah. Well, now I'm what? Squanto is a great story. You know, and he's from that part of the world, and he greeted the pilgrims in English because he had actually been. It's like fascinating.
Sure.
So
he's also, by the way, at 60%. Wait, he's at 60% in the prediction markets. So that's the other thing is, like, if you're wondering, does this matter? Do the people vote on this? Like, prediction markets say no.
And Maine is one of the less educated states in the country. So infer from that what you want. But
you do see that he is dropping in the polls. And Ken Paxton, there has been a precipitous decline.
He's dropping like a towel on a kick profile, or so I hear. Ken Paxton, who has a name, Matt, you'll agree, he sounds like a mid-70s Astros utility infielder. Or maybe a 20-game losing pitcher. Ken Paxton pushed for the state of Texas to put the Ten Commandments in every K through 12 classroom, even as his wife of like a thousand years last year filed divorce, quote, for biblical reasons. So again, you know, like, these are weird bookends and things like that. The sexting scandal, the way I read, or what I read about it in the New York Times, like, it's not actual. You can say character matters, and of course it does. He and his wife seem to be dealing with it, and I don't think that would disqualify him. I would never vote for Graham Plattner because he's a communist, a socialist, and a liar about growing up in a wealthy elite background and then pretending to be like, oh, I'm just Jimmy Oyster Boy, when he owns the fucking farm, you know, that he co-owns the oyster farm. Like, that enough. That's like the fakery.
The anti-war hero who signed up, volunteered for Blackwater.
That's
kind of in,
which I think is now called Philip Morris, but I'm not sure.
I'll try.
It's instructive because for as many times as Peter can say the phrase abundance agenda on this podcast, who actually quickens the pulse of Democrats? Who gets the beautiful, you know, New York Magazine and New York Times fluff treatment months and months out in advance? It is aggro Bernie bros. It is people who are, if not outright Democratic socialists, really, really close to it. And it's not just the sexting. I listen to him talk for 30 seconds. Anyone who has not listened to him up till now, it's just going to be like, the only real problem in this country is the billionaires. It's like, okay. Like, everything about the guy, you know where he comes from. You know what he's like. And for me, that is incredibly off-putting. And the fact that it is quickening pulses among the Democratic Party kind of electorate and chattering classes is indicative of the bad moment that we are in.
Matt, real quick before we go, do you want to say anything about the Democratic race for governor in California, which features an actual billionaire, Tom Steyer, who has seemingly bought every single ad that is available in the state of California to run against billionaires?
Yeah, it's crazy. And running against Javier Becerra, who no one ever in the history of the world has ever liked or said was good at anything.
Including the people who have appointed him to things.
He sucked.
He ran HHS.
Did you go to high school? Like, did you lose a bowling tournament to Javier Becerra? Your anger at him is purified.
No, my anger.
Did you go to high school with Mike Pence, Nick?
Precisely.
I don't know.
I lived in Ohio for a long time.
It's precisely because that type of bland mediocrity is something that Democrats are like, oh, you know, that's just the way Californians are. Like, no, dude, you appointed someone with no qualifications to be the head of HHS during a pandemic. Like, that's a party that's not working very well at the federal level. And then at the state and local level, you can't fire Karen Bass. You can't fire Gavin Newsom, and you will run against Trump forever. Amen. It's terrible and desultory. And I wish that our one abundance bro who's running in the race, Matt Mahan, or however I pronounce his name, would have gotten anywhere. And he didn't. It's a sick state of affairs for a state that I love.
Can I just ask a very quick question? And Peter, I would be interested. You probably know more about this than anybody. California is an open primary state. So if there isn't a clear winner, the top two, or I guess even if there is, the top two go on to a big election. And that might be Steve Hilton, the former Fox News host, the British guy, which should automatically, you know, mean that he's not available to hold office in America. But do we like this? Because the idea behind the open primary, it's supposed to like minimize the extremism, you know, cut down on costs and stuff. And it seems to me like recent results from California, open primary races kind of sucked.
It murdered third parties in California. I mean, at the time it was pitched as a way to enable third parties, and it was a lie.
Yeah.
And everyone from third parties was like, are you kidding? You're killing us right now with this. Yeah, it's led to mostly Democrat on Democrat stuff. Hopefully, you know, in this season, there would be enough anti-incumbency sentiment to make it possible, at least a puncher's chance for either what's his face, or Chad Hilton, I guess is the other guy, that's San Bernardino County.
Steve Hilton, Chad Bianco.
But also Spencer Pratt in the LA mayor's race. But functionally, it's just been here's how you get to the top two Democrats as quickly as possible. It's been a very bad system.
All right. Speaking of things that are very bad, we got to move on real quick and talk about Iran. So last week, you guys had a discussion about what did we learn in a big picture sense from this whole fiasco. The answer turned out is nothing, but there's been a whole additional week since then. And when you recorded the podcast, which I wasn't on, thank you, Matt Welch, for stepping in to host. Good show. When you recorded the podcast, it was like, maybe there's going to be a deal by the time we're done recording this podcast. And then there wasn't a deal that day. And there wasn't a deal the next day, but the next day they said, hey, maybe there's going to be a deal today. And then the day after that, they said the same thing. And the day after that, they said the same thing. And now, as we are recording this podcast today on Monday, there are headlines about how actually the shooting started again, but maybe there's going to be a deal. So Catherine, my question for you is the Strait of Hormuz open? No, but like, did we learn anything at all this week about this nonsense?
Stop asking that. We're not going to learn anything. We, this podcast, are not going to learn anything. And we, America, are not going to learn anything. And we, the world, are not going to learn anything. I don't know what to tell you, man. I guess we could be having like a reversal thing. Since as this podcast begins, it looks like there is no deal in sight. Maybe by the time we release the podcast, there will be a deal. Like it's opposite day.
But also, maybe we will be bombing them even more by then. Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with a listener question about the fighting on the White House lawn professionally, I think. The Reason Roundtable is sponsored by BetterHelp. The sun is out, the days are warmer, and summer is here. For some folks, summer is the very best season, but with kids at home, vacations planned, and schedules up in the air, juggling all of this can be difficult. Look, I know. I'm away from home a lot this summer, and while it is fun, it can also be stressful. You want to make the most of the summer sun, all that freedom you have, but you don't want to do so much that you feel burnt out. You just don't enjoy it. You need to set boundaries and have clear expectations with yourself so that you actually enjoy the season. If you need help figuring out how to do that, consider therapy from BetterHelp. It is the largest online therapy platform, and people who use it say it works. There are over 1.7 million client reviews, and they are overwhelmingly positive. BetterHelp gives you choices. There are over 30,000 therapists. You just take a short questionnaire. They're going to connect you with one that works for you. And then if you want to switch, you can. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. Find support in therapy. Sign up, get 10% off at betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. A reminder, we love to answer your questions. Please send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long questions to podcasts@reason.com. That is podcasts@reason.com. And thank you so much for putting listener question in the subject line. It really helps. This week's listener question comes from John, who directs his question at Matt Welch, noted John McCain biographer, Matt Welch. Mm. John writes, Trump is planning a UFC patch on the White House lawn. I think they're calling it the Claw. It's a giant dome for fighting in, right? They're building it right now. Can you trace this moment to John McCain calling MMA, mixed martial arts, human cockfighting? This was a sort of big culture war that I think people have forgotten. Joe Rogan, AKA male Oprah Winfrey, has always disliked neocons. Disliking McCain era neocons is a staple of this sort of manosphere world. I think a lot of this might have roots in the early opposition McCain took against MMA. So it is this sort of butterfly effect to this moment where UFC is happening on the White House lawn and Dana White has more political power than Roger Goodell. Matt Welch, John McCain biographer, trace the history for us.
Hey, Catherine, who's Roger Goodell?
I don't know. Sports ball?
Mm-hmm. Very good.
That's a good answer.
Very, very good.
I'm intrigued by the theory. I love like long stretches. I'm a Greil Marcus fan, like anyone else.
Yeah.
So I like it. I don't really think that the way to look at it, McCain's both his opposition to MMA initially and some of the kind of interestingnesses of the Trump coalition and the upcoming fight, I think is as follows. McCain, to a degree that was never really fully appreciated, was always an elitist. I mean, the dude grew up around and near Capitol Hill. His dad was a congressional liaison. They were having fancy dinners at all times. He was palling around Vietnam with Johnny Apple from the New York Times. He's always felt comfortable in those places much more than he's felt comfortable in kind of crass Americana or even just grassroots Republican politics, like around Christian conservatives or just grassroots activists. He's always like, and that's one reason why journalists love him. From all of that, I think his reaction, extreme reaction against MMA at the beginning, was essentially an elitist reaction. It was just like, you know, when MMA shows up, first of all, professional wrestling is disreputable by fancy people. And then suddenly now we're doing this kind of crazy, like vicious looking mixed martial arts. So it made sense in that way. It's a pretty traditional kind of elitist way with the McCain kind of method of doing statism whenever he feels like there's something about America that's being demoralized. I think I've always found what's one of the most interesting and kind of uplifting is the wrong word, but just like interesting parts about the Trump coalition is precisely this. Trump, he kind of likes America. There isn't really a lot of places in America that he says horrible things about everybody all the time. Sure. But he likes crass Americana and has brought that in. If you look at the comparison between the 2024 Republican National Convention and the Democrats, it was night and day. Democrats are always congratulating themselves that they can get the best talent in the room. You know, Stevie Wonder will show up or whatever. And Republicans just like, wow, that's a hot topic in Cleveland. And it's great. It's like a bunch of people with tattoos and it's just more loose and weird, kind of like America is. So I don't know if it's cause and effect of all of this, but I think it's certainly a symptom that the revulsion against this was very elite. Neocons tend to be themselves elite. And the Trump coalition is just more kind of ragtag and I think ultimately sociologically interesting.
Yeah, it's much more Jacksonian, you know, and yeah. Jackson had the giant wheel of cheese at his inauguration and things like that.
Yeah.
Trump is doing MMA or UFC because it's popular. Back in the day when he was a casino owner, he would host heavyweight fights and middleweight fights when that was big business. He participated in professional wrestling, heel games and things like that. And UFC is where the action is because, as Matt was saying, you know, for a wide variety of reasons, UFC and MMA, you know, which is a larger category, is kind of like, you know, it's an American sport form that kind of grows out of the movie Idiocracy. The Octagon was named for, you know, the fighting thing in Conan the Barbarian and whatnot. And it's kind of a great mix of all kinds of stuff. And it's really popular. You know, is it 10 years ago that our former colleague Carrie Howley wrote Throne, which was a book about mixed martial arts in Iowa, kind of taking energy away from wrestling. And wrestling in the plain states and the upper Midwest is as American as apple pie, and it just doesn't have the juice anymore. Trump is doing this because it's popular. And Dana White, who is a very strange and interesting entrepreneur, and he is like, you know, this generation's version of Vince McMahon and whatnot, except that UFC is actually on the up and up as a physical battle, like perfectly pitched. I mean, it's fucked up that the White House is, you know, hosting actual like league sporting events, because you know that Trump and his stupid kids are getting some money off of this, or they're going to release a shit coin about it and stuff like that. But, you know, it's a good impulse.
Catherine, I trimmed this question somewhat, but sort of as he goes on, he connects the rise of the manosphere and its dislike of neocons to McCain's MMA stance. And you worked at the Weekly Standard. You also last week said that you had been researching men.
Yes.
So,
noted manosphere expert Catherine Mengi Ward is here to serve as
your
correspondent.
You're the Ariana Falachi of the manosphere. Yeah.
There are just not many people in this world who are like, I know neocons and I understand men, at least not on this podcast. So I'm going to have to ask you, what do you think about all that?
I think just hearing you say it out loud makes me realize that I neither know neocons nor understand men, and to presume otherwise would be foolishness. And in fact, I did get, thank you, listeners and viewers, several notes telling me to shut my mouth, which is fair, because at least 75% of this podcast is more expert on men than I am, probably. So that's fair enough. I just loved this letter. I honestly don't, I truly don't have a sophisticated analysis of the politics underlying this, but this letter was so specific and so confident about its thesis and knew who to like turn to for confirmation in Matt. It was just a beautiful letter. I think reversible pageantry is the least offensive thing that Trump does on the regular. Like, he can have a big dumb parade and then we pack the parade away and maybe we just don't do that parade again later. This seems to ish maybe be in that category, and so is therefore lower on my list of concerns than other problems.
You know what this reminds me of is Mortal Kombat 2, the movie that I just saw, and the original controversy about the Mortal Kombat video game also in the 1990s. Because, you know, as I talked about on this pod a couple of weeks ago, there's a new Mortal Kombat movie out. It's really cheesy, really campy. It's sort of effective if you like these games and the movies. But in the 1990s, this was like literally a national emergency, multiple congressional hearings, just this huge panic about these games, which were, in fact, somewhat bloody, somewhat more violent than other games that had come before them. Like, it was a little bit novel in that sense, in the way that some of the MMA stuff is a little more violent than old, you know, than boxing was in the 1950s or whatever. But Congress made this huge deal out of it. This is something that Congress did with any number of things in the 1990s. And what happened in every case, they basically shone a spotlight on these cultural forms, and they helped mainstream them. And now what you see in the 2020s is with MMA and UFC and with Mortal Kombat, all of that stuff has become kitsch. It has just become cultural kitsch that no one cares about anymore. And I would expect many of the same things to happen with all of the panics about AI and the internet and social media that we see today. 30 years from now, people are going to look back at that stuff and say, who cares? It wasn't a big deal. And it's just going to be normalized, because that is the pattern that you see every single time with Mortal Kombat, with UFC, with video games, whatever it is. This stuff just becomes a mainstream part of America. Maybe it's crass, maybe it's vulgar, but it's mainstream and it's kitsch. And that's what you see. That's what you see with McCain. It's what you see with Lieberman. Pretty much anytime one of these politicians decides to grandstand about one of these issues. All right, let's shift gears just a little bit and talk about taxes and Nancy Mace. So the South Carolina Republican now says that our seniors should not pay property taxes. Reasons Eric Boehm wrote about this for us last week, and he said this sort of thing is bad news. But it's a tax break, right, Catherine? Aren't tax breaks good? Don't we like them?
Yeah, we do like people to pay less taxes, but we like taxes to be simple and fair. And just randomly having boomers not pay property taxes is neither of those things. We want the overall tax burden to be less, but we also want overall spending to be less. And nothing like that seems to be happening. So, when we hear this proposal, I think it's generational warfare bait from the boomer side. And I admire and appreciate that Eric takes the bait every time. And he probably should put like a couple more sentences in some of what he writes where he says stuff like, reminder that we want to abolish Social Security because actually you didn't pay in and your money isn't there. It's all a lie. And that's not the fault of the seniors. That's the fault of the federal government and the lies that they have been telling all this time. The malefactor here is and always will be the government, not the olds. And I just want to be clear about that. But this is a bad proposal and it won't solve any of our problems at all.
Matt, it seems like there's a sort of a trend here. There's part of a boom in very narrow, targeted tax breaks. I mean, it started in some ways with Trump, like the no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, no tax on auto loan interest. There's some of this stuff at the state level I was just looking at. Florida took a temporary exemption for disaster preparedness and outdoor items, made it permanent last year. Connecticut has an annual temporary sales tax holiday on clothing and shoes that cost less than $100. There's obviously also stuff like film tax credits in New Jersey and Georgia that are just really distorting the shape of the film industry. How do you sort of conceptualize this? What do you think this signals, that politicians are rushing not to lower taxes in the sort of general sense, but instead to just lower very specific taxes on specific things?
It makes sense in a high polarization, low trust, and very rancorous political environment, that you would see the, you know, what is the whip hand that you have ultimately as a legislator or as a politician? It's how and when you do the tax thing and the regulation thing on some level too, and spending. So what you're seeing now is that everyone is looking for the people in their coalition that they can reward and the people in the bad guy coalition that they can punish. And I would highlight some of those punitive ones too. We've been talking about tax breaks reason for a really long time and about how they're very inefficient. All the film tax credits, targeted tax, TIFs, and all this stuff. We've been writing about this stuff for decades. And that
PUDs.
They're inefficient as all get out. They make a lot of work for lawyers, and they depend on how much you're able to suck up to politicians. All of that doesn't really work, even if it's generally nice to have people pay fewer taxes. But now we're seeing let's do a specific tax in New York City on owners of pied-à-terres that are worth more than this. Let's in California, let's do this most asinine ballot proposition to backdate taxes based not on income, but on wealth, which is crazy. People are looking for punitive taxes. There's the slush fund that Trump has been proposing, the $1.776 billion fund to pay out to people who were victims of government weaponization of the FBI and such like. There is now proposals by Gavin Newsom in California and at least one other state, Kathy Hochul maybe it was, in New York, saying that we will tax anybody in our state who receives that money 100%. So you're just finding the people that you hate and you want to tax them 100%, and you find the people that you don't like, and you're going to get rid of all of their taxes forever and ever and amen. And all of it is bad. All of it is bad. As Catherine points out, the gold standard here is to have as simplified a tax system as possible, simplified and low, and then commensurate low price of government. So if you really want to cut taxes, cut government. No one's talking about that. Do that. And all these little sort of micro things, it's make work for lawyers and politicians and political consultants. And it does nothing good for overall society and health and just sort of like the sense of what are we doing here? We're not looking for people to punish or reward. That's very bad.
Yeah, taxes shouldn't be used for punishments. They shouldn't be used for rewards. They shouldn't be used to shape behavior. This is the problem, I think, Nick, that functionally, these are taxes being used as regulations.
Yeah, well, and this was a big conservative Republican talking point in the 90s, actually starting in the 80s and then 90s, to say that, the Democrats use the tax code as a form of social engineering to reward and punish people for this or that economic decision. Obviously, no Republican has had that thought, 25 or more years, or at least doesn't talk about it openly. I think, the other thing about the whole Nancy Mace thing, and the current governor of Indiana is also talking similar ways, but many southern states already massively advantage seniors or retirees. So in many of the states, they're exempt from all education taxes. They typically already start off paying lower property taxes because they get a bigger exemption and things like that. So this, in a way, it's nothing new. It's just Nancy Mace figuring out a way to, get back into a news cycle somehow by annoying at least the four of us, if not 95% of America. But there are better ways to do this. And there are states, you mentioned, Florida has some weird and bullshit kind of exemptions, Peter, but Ron DeSantis has actually been talking about lowering property taxes across the board and things like that. You see various states, including some liberal or states that are run by Democrats, that are working to get rid of state income taxes and things like that. So there's a flame still flickering about like just having, you know, flat, fair, transparent, obvious, easy to understand, easy to calculate taxes, you know, the primary taxes. That's the thing that we should be, you know, working towards, not just at the state and local level too, but also at the, you know, at the federal level. And it would be great if people, you know, if we started saying, no, you know, instead of saying the starting point is always how much do we want to spend in any polity, it's like how much money have we raised? And that's the limit of what we can spend in a given year. And just flip that, that would be much, much better.
Yeah, but ask any politician and the amount that we've raised is never enough. All right, let's keep the flame of this podcast burning just a little bit longer with our cultural recommendations, what we have been watching, reading, otherwise consuming in the cultural space this week. Catherine Rangi Ward, let's start with you.
I read another business book. I read Incorruptible, Why Good Companies Go Bad and How Great Companies Stay Great by Eric Ries. He wrote most famously The Lean Startup, which was a sort of seminal business book. I knew Eric in college. We were pals. We were in the same debating society. We played poker together. I witnessed his first startup. And
did it go well?
It went well enough for him to write a best-selling book about being a startup guy. And I think, which means it didn't go 100% well. And a lot of what this book is about is, well, what happens when it doesn't go 100% well? How do you stay true to kind of the mission of your company? How do you stay true to your vision? And how do you stay true to actually doing something good in the world? But what I wanted to talk about with this book is, it's, I guess, his like third or fourth book. And there's something about this stage, I think, in people's careers where they start to like revert to their true selves. So this book has way more Nietzsche in it than you would expect from a business book. And I loved that about it. This is the Eric that I knew in college. Like, there's a part of the book where he is literally sobbing on the bathroom floor at 3 a.m. It's good stuff. It's also,
that doesn't sound very Nietzschean.
So he was attempting to start and did eventually successfully start a stock exchange geared toward long-term thinking. So we talked about stakeholders at the beginning of this podcast. The idea is that you would try to kind of incorporate thinking beyond the quarterly returns, the kind of liquidity events, the kind of short-term thinking that dominates lots of companies and eventually forces them almost like a gravitational pull to stray from the thing they set out to do. It's not going well at this moment in the founding of this company. And there's sort of an existential threat and he's really upset about it. And he talks about sort of the rest of his team pulling him through because he was too sad, which I think is pretty interesting. I also found it very useful for reason. Obviously, we do not have the profit motive to keep us on the straight and narrow, but we also do not have the kind of short-term thinking that especially publicly traded companies often suffer from. And I think we've done a really good job of staying true to our mission and vision. And I think a lot of that has to do with thinking as broadly as we can about what we are for as an institution, as an entity. And
what are we for?
Keeping around the people who conceived of what we were for originally, like the great Bob Poole. Hopefully we're doing our part for free minds and free markets. Eric Ries is doing his part for long-term thinking in those free minds and free markets. And there's just a lot of staring into the abyss in this business book, and I recommend it. Incorrect.
I hope I can share this, but I do recall many years ago, there was a sort of a consultant that came in and talked to people at Reason about what it is we do here, right? It was one of those kinds of things. And the one note that I remember from the response, the report was, wow, this organization is really well aligned, right? Which is an unusual thing. And just to brag about Reason, and one thing that I think is great about working at Reason is we're all on the same page about what it is we exist to do. That's not necessarily true for every little specific thing that we do, right? About, you know, the little process, but like we are all really, really on the same page about what we are here for. And that is, it's a nice thing about working at Reason. Nick, do you have something for us?
Yes. I watched what is actually the series finale of Euphoria, the HBO show that started as a I like to think of it as a lighthearted version of the Archie comics. It was a bunch of lovable Muppets in high school. And then it got dark. That's a joke. Obviously, either nobody here has seen the show or that joke isn't funny, either way. But it was the series, the third series, and it takes place a few years after they've all graduated from high school. And this is the show with Sydney Sweeney and Jason,
Jacob Elordi.
Jacob Elordi, thank you. Are kind of the big
Wuthering
breakout
Heights
stars.
Fame.
Yes, most recently. What's great about it is that, like all of the best kind of serious dramas that kind of made HBO's bones back in the day, it takes place in a fundamentally diseased and horrifying moral universe. And you kind of root for the characters, the protagonists, to come out of that universe untouched by it. And without doing any spoiler alerts, what's most satisfying about the actual finale is that, like Boardwalk Empire and like The Sopranos, and maybe, you know, The Doors, no one here gets out alive, kind of, one way or the other. And I think that's great. It is, you know, because it's ultimately, it's dissatisfying from a kind of fan perspective, but it is extremely gratifying and true from a, you know, the dramatic logic of a universe that starts out over the in a different setting. I likened the moral universe of Euphoria to the one that Seneca, is best known as a Stoic philosopher now, but he wrote a bunch of tragedies that always take place in just an absolutely brutally morally compromised universe. And that's where the show unfolds. It's where it starts and where it ends. So it's very good. And the whole thing is available on HBO, the three seasons. And it's worth checking out.
And it's a show about the youth, right? Like you're supposed to learn about
kind
what
of,
like.
Yeah. Now. Yeah. And of course it isn't. I mean, like, you know, Archie or Grease or anything, everybody's suspiciously old in the show. And it is always
certainly
an
by
older,
season three.
Yeah. But it's also, it, you know, it's an older person kind of reflecting, oh, this is the high school I wish I went to. Etc. So, you know, it's not sociological, it's dramaturgical, but it succeeds on that front.
I learned a few things about the youth this weekend because I watched the movie Backrooms, which was directed by a 19-20-year-old who he's just turned 21, but basically after the film was finalized. This is it is a movie that is adapted from a series of YouTube shorts. And those YouTube shorts were based on a meme about liminal spaces and sort of yellowy walled empty office buildings. And he built this out into a film series that he started by doing just on his computer using 3D modeling technology, right? This wasn't something that he went out and shot in an actual environment. And over time, this became a huge, huge hit. And he ended up at the ripe old age of 19 or 20, directing his first feature film. And folks, it made something like $85 million at the box office this weekend. It basically made what Star Wars made the weekend before. And this is just, this is a revolution. This is a huge moment this weekend, right now, in Hollywood, in cinema, because the top two movies at the box office are both movies made by 20-somethings with backgrounds in making movies for YouTube, and Star Wars is failing. And this is the next era. And what's really interesting about Backrooms is it's not just based on, you know, his YouTube series and this internet meme that is a sort of collective folk fiction about, you know, the liminal spaces and weird office buildings. It is also, like, he thinks of this as an IP. And it is also really heavily drawing from video games. He told the New York Times that the thing he would really like to do would be to adapt the Portal video games. And you can just see the DNA of first-person puzzle-based kind of narrative video games and the weirdness of just kind of exploring these vast digital spaces all over this movie. It's fantastic. It's, I think the third act, it's not, is not quite as good as the first hour, but it's a completely fantastic movie, and especially impressive that it was made by someone this young. This is the biggest debut ever for someone of that age. He is the youngest film director to ever have a number one movie. It's Backrooms. If you haven't heard about it yet, you will. This is going to change Hollywood in a big way. Matt Welch.
Cool. So Paul McCartney, Sir Paul, came out with a new record last week called The Boys of Dungeon Lane. And as whenever he releases something, I've been listening to it over and over and over and over again, because just saying my gratitude for his work over the years to treat his new stuff with seriousness. And as part of that, I went and watched the Morgan Neville documentary that came out last year called Man on the Run. It was about basically Paul's 70s career, starting and, not starting very well, but then eventually launching Wings, the band that is now also in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And they'd sold a kajillion records and had a lot of number one hits and tours and, you know, pot busts in Japan and all the usual stuff. It's just about that. That's what it is. It's Paul after the Beatles have broken up. He's obviously traumatized and shattered by it. They don't hit that too heavily. And all the footage, thankfully, there's a lot of really great talking voices, but not heads. So all the footage is of Paul and of Wings and of things that they're doing. And then you hear, you know, Chrissy Hynde talking like, all right. And other people, including most of the whatever surviving limping members of Wings were, and who most of whom are like, you know, he was trying to pretend that he had a band. It's like Paul McCartney over here, who can play every instrument better than all of us, and who can't be seen in public because he gets mobbed, but he's going out there anyways. I found it interesting as a Beatle nut. And as someone who likes music documentaries, it always gets to a point in these people where you realize they just work 75 times harder than everybody and they're absolutely manic about it. I appreciated that. And then also the sense that he needs a chip on his shoulder, which he still is not over the way that critics reacted to his admittedly great 1971 album, Ram. And then, I teared up a couple times when Sean Lennon is talking about Paul and like the incredible once in a millennium partnership between two people. It's pretty moving. It's the same problems that Nick and I have been talking about forever about documentaries of famous people. In exchange for getting all of the rights to all the songs and making it worth watching, it's not going to hit too close to everything. And there's I'm sure some kind of veto power that they could have exercised over it getting too close to the bone, but very interesting and entertaining, and I recommend it. Solid B, gentlemen.
Some of the most amazing androgynous shag haircuts.
Oh my God.
You know, this side of the cover of David Bowie's Pinups, where David Bowie and Twiggy are interchangeable with interchangeable hair.
Yeah. And I like how they, Stella McCartney, who's obviously a designer, was just talking about how just awesome her mom's fashion is, which is not how most people think of it, including her haircuts that Nick's mentions, which are like, you've never seen mullets like that. Just like
she mullets,
world champion mullets. But it's like, no, she's great. She had her own style. It was awesome.
Matt, if you're interested in, there's a chapter, or it might be scattered throughout the book, in Helen Lewis's The Genius Myth. She draws a great, kind of like she discusses the burden that McCartney bears because he continued to live, whereas John Lennon's death ended things. And that sets up an interesting kind of dichotomy in the way that critics and fans and people just think about the two of them. And she's very much on the McCartney side, but it's really good. I know you, and I suspect everybody else or many other people, are big Beatles fans. It's a really interesting discussion of fire and ice, and the athlete dying young versus the person getting to age old enough where you get to retell the story, but you're never quite as beloved as the one who died a long time ago.
Stephen Hyden, the great rock critic, pointed out after in his reaction to Man on Run, it's like, it's amazing that Paul still isn't over, not just the trauma that happened, that's understandable, but like people's kind of unfair treatment of him, when in fact everyone's moved on. Everyone likes Paul now. There's no one left to be mad at Paul McCartney, really, except snobs. But it still drives him, and it drives him to continue to make listenable and interesting music at the age of 83, which is great.
You mentioned the kind of insatiable drive to work harder than everybody else, and actually made me think of the kid who directed the YouTube movie I just mentioned. When he talked to the New York Times, he talked about sort of putting in just crazy, crazy hours to get this film over the finish line and to finish it, working like 18 hours a day. He's got health issues and he's powering through all of this. And he has just decided to kind of grind it out. And yes, he also had talent. And yes, he also got lucky. But it was that incredible work ethic, that you know, that push to just get it done, whatever it took and whatever it cost, I think, you don't see in everyone. And that is how you end up with a major movie deal when you are 19 years old. Okay, we are in fact done with our hard work for this hour here. That is our show. Thank you for watching and listening. If you like what we do, you can support our work at reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. The Reason Roundtable will return.